If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather and we're going to march and we're going to blow its f***ing house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Today, we are kicking off Pride Month with a roundtable discussion featuring queer voices from inside the magical community. I thought it would be really interesting to sort of do a check-in. We've done kind of similar shows before about the intersections of queer identity within the magical community and how those two identities intersect, diverge, overlap, et cetera, et cetera. But I thought it would be nice to go back and sort of do a check-in, and get some other voices in the mix to kind of discuss how far the pagan community, the magical community, has come as far as inclusivity, representation, celebration of queer identity inside of the magical community, and maybe where there are some pain points still some spots where some growth might need to happen. It's a big, beautiful, messy discussion, and I was so privileged to get to have it. Since lockdown early last year, I haven't really gotten to feel like I've been able to be in community, not just within the pagan and magical community, but within the queer community. I've kind of missed pride events. I've missed, getting to sit and be in conversation with people that kind of get where you're coming from. It's a really special, really magical conversation. It's kind of a long one, so I'm not going to sit here and beat around the bush. Enjoy this Queer Riot Roundtable. Well, welcome back to Inciting a Riot. I am so excited because we have some returning guests and some new guests to the show, a new guest to the show here to kick off Pride Month. We are going to have a roundtable today of queer witches, magical practitioners from around the world, which is really cool. I love when we get to do these kinds of things. I want to welcome to the show Phoenix, Mara, and Honey. I'm going to go here in the order in which you are on my screen. Phoenix, welcome back to Inciting a Riot. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. And thank you for having me back.
Oh my gosh, of course. You were such a big part of the Black Lives Matter Roundtable. Really, like this time last year is when we first got on each other's radar. I am so grateful that you agreed to come back. Your perspective is invaluable. For folks that either haven't listened to that show or maybe have slept since then, remind folks who you are and what you do.
Yeah, so my name is Phoenix Coffin Williams. I am a licensed clinical mental health counselor and also a Wiccan High Priest. I live in Buffalo, New York, where I have my practice and my ministry. And that's mostly how I spend my time, aside from being in graduate school, pastoral counseling, doctoral program, which I'm super excited to be hopefully wrapping up in a few.
Woo! We love a licensed professional witch. We love it. Mara Starling, welcome back to Inciting a Riot. You've been here the most recent, so I'm so glad that you agreed to come back and that I haven't run you off. Shade, I love it. So for folks that either haven't listened to that show or, again, have slept since then, remind folks who you are and what you do out there in the witchy world.
Well, hello. So I'm Mara Starling. I am a Welsh folk witch. I'm a first language Welsh speaker, and I'm passionate about sharing about the history of folk magical practices, as well as the mythology and folklore that stem from my landscape. And I'm an upcoming author, and I'm really delighted to be here because I'm also trans and I don't get to speak about that much because I focus predominantly on Welsh witchy things.
Well, it's one, you buried the lead a little bit there. We get to celebrate with you the fact that you just got a book deal. That's amazing. That's so cool. That's so awesome. Since you already mentioned it, go ahead and give us a quick plug. What's the title? When's it coming out?
Yeah, so my book is being published by Llewellyn Publications. It's going to be called Welsh Witchcraft, A Guide to the Spirits, Lore and Magic of Wales. And it should be coming out in early 2022, hopefully.
I'm all so
things
excited.
Going well.
I cannot wait to pre-order it. I'm so pumped for you. This is so great. I'm excited.
Thank you.
Honey, welcome to Inciting a Riot. This is your first time.
Yes, I'm very excited.
Oh, gosh. I'm so glad to have you here. So for folks that don't know you, tell folks a little bit about yourself and your platform.
So I am known as That Honey Witch on TikTok. I am non-binary. I'm a newer practitioner for hoodoo, but I consider myself an eclectic hoodoo practitioner because I am half Italian, half Black, and I am also in my second year of grad school now for forensic science.
Yes. Oh gosh, some educated witches in the house. I'm so excited. So we're going to start off really, really easy. And, you know, sort of like Mara brought up, we don't often, most of us who do interviews or have public platforms where we talk about witchy things, we tend to only ever really focus on those platforms about the witchy things and don't really focus on our identities. And oftentimes we find that when we do talk about our authentic identities, gender identity, sexual identity, et cetera, on our public platforms, suddenly that turns people off. It's like, oh gosh, I came here for witches. I didn't come here for trans content. I do want to start off talking about you and your journey to getting to your authentic identity. And I actually want to start off with Honey here, because Honey has been very, very vocal on their TikTok channel talking about your discovery, rediscovery, and ongoing journey to yourself. So if you don't mind, let's start with you.
It's very, I think honestly, it's helpful to have it on a public platform, because it was like, I've known for a long time that I've been, you know, queer. And I've just kind of accepted that. But one day I kind of just woke up and I was like, I didn't feel like a woman today. And I bet other people feel that way too. So I just went on TikTok and I was like, I had a gender crisis at 11 o'clock at night. Does anyone else feel this way? What's happening? This is so weird. And it's not weird. It's kind of just a part of life. And a lot of people attribute the fact that like younger people are having these gender crises to being in quarantine and just being by themselves and just discovering themselves. I kind of just attribute it to the fact that like we have so much time to just explore ourselves in our own mind. You know what I'm saying? And I chose my name Honey because my name is That Honey Witch. And people just started calling me Honey, and that made me so happy. Like, just to hear people say that, like, oh, hey, Honey, how you doing? I'm like, wow, that made my heart soar. But yeah, definitely. And there's people that will judge me and say, because when I first started using she, they pronouns, people were like, you can't do that. That's an insult to trans people. And I was like, Actually, I can do whatever I want with my pronouns. And that was a big step to see how the internet can kind of be beneficial, even though it has these negative responses, if that makes sense. Because you have to face it, and then you can say, actually, I am sure of myself.
Mara, you've sort of also had a bit of a journey of both gender and witchcraft online in spaces where people, you know, you've tweeted about this and you've sort of dealt with this, I think, from maybe a bit more of a negative perspective than Honey has, where people log onto your channel and say, I just came here for Welsh witches and fairies. I didn't come here for trans content. What are some of the ways and pitfalls that you've found having your identity online?
I think when I first started kind of putting myself out there online, I didn't start talking about witchcraft. I actually started a YouTube channel originally back in 2015, talking about my transition, because that's when I was starting to go the medical route. And I wanted to do a bit of a video about what it's like transitioning in the UK, because whenever I looked up vlogs or anything about transitioning, they were always American. So I was like, I want to know what it's like for someone who is in the UK. Because obviously we have a different medical system over here to what you guys have. And I started that and I did get a lot of attention, but I didn't really like the attention that I was getting. There was a lot of fetishization and a lot of people that I didn't really want to be watching it and such. And then I started talking about my Welsh witchy things on a separate channel, and that really took off. And so I kind of stuck to that one and made all the other videos private because I didn't want that to mix. But obviously, if I'm presenting myself online, every now and then I'm going to want to talk about things other than witchcraft and Welsh things. And so I did. I started putting other videos out there. Specifically, my first video that I made to do with my identity was one that talked about my pronouns, because people kept commenting on my videos, because I'm quite a theatrical person on TikTok and YouTube. I dance around in parks and things talking about folklore. And I think people were very confused looking at me, because I think I looked feminine to people, but then I was dressed like some kind of otherworldly fae creature. And then I was also like, my voice is very jarring to some people. I get a lot of comments even today, like about people who say, I did not expect that voice to come out of that type of person. And I'm always like, okay, cool. Is that an insult or? But so doing my videos like that and like, you know, being very big and theatrical and being like, good morning, how are you? And jumping on the screen. I got a lot of comments asking, what are your pronouns? How do we respect your identity? And I thought that was great. That was amazing. And TikTok was the only platform that's ever happened. I mean, nobody has ever done that before. And it was quite liberating to be asked first and foremost, like, what is your identity? How do we respect your identity? And so I put a video out there saying like, okay, these are my pronouns. And I made it a bit of a theatrical thing where I talked about like how my identity exists beyond the confines of your feeble mortal understanding of gender and all that. But I still tried to make it clear what my pronouns are. And I said that I'm she, her, or they, them, depending on whatever you prefer to call me. And so many people commented on that video saying, I don't care, just carry on talking about Welsh stuff. And I think a lot of the times people thought they were being open-minded by saying that. They thought they were being kind by saying that. They were like, we don't care about that. But they would come across sometimes as a bit like they were saying, we don't care about you. We only care about your content. We don't care about the person behind it. We only care about what you're talking about. And that kind of made me feel a bit, And then recently, I don't know if you saw my recent tweet, but I put up something about being trans on Twitter or on Instagram, I think it was actually. And somebody literally messaged me saying, stop talking about being trans. It gives it pulls me away from the fantasy of imagining that you're some kind of fairy creature. And I was like, okay. Cool, good for you. So yeah, it's very strange. I think there's a lack of respect there for the people putting out this content and how people just use it as a resource rather than as a human being that has a life as well. So yeah, I'm still kind of figuring out how to deal with it all.
So many of us, when we choose to share parts of ourselves online, I don't think any of us is using a name that was on our birth certificate in some way. So in some form or fashion, each of us has chosen a facet of ourselves to share with other people. And it is interesting when people talk to us and want us to only ever be the character of ourselves, the part of ourselves that we use to entertain other people. Does anybody have any feelings in that space?
To think that to be in such a niche, such as witchcraft and magical and spiritual realms, and expect us to be only that all of the time makes no sense. It's illogical, to say the least.
Does anybody ever feel, I mean, like, when you receive those comments, you can kind of tell that maybe the person like meant it as a joke or thought that you were going to take it as a joke, but it, I don't know, I only ever feel of it like, you know, the gay minstrel or something like that. And like, oh, you just think I'm here to be that 90s gay stereotype. Like, you know, you think I'm just here to entertain you. I don't know. And then I feel like I have to like double down and get like extra, like I have to go like hard in the opposite direction for like a few weeks or something and get like way too serious. Does anybody have that, Phoenix?
So I find myself walking this fine line between being on purpose the fun, like most favorite parts of the stereotype, and then also like simultaneously doubling down on like the boundaries that are around like the things that are specifically important to me, like in a certain context. Right. So like, yeah, I'm super friendly and fun and cool, and you can like generally come up and hug me, and like I'll likely do a shot with some strangers at the bar, like, right? And I'll probably just be dancing pretty phenomenally in the center of the floor with a bunch of people also happy around my happy gay ass. Like, that is very likely going to happen. Like, I probably can name a bunch of people who are addicted to, like, crystal meth. And, like, I can talk about, like, the work that has to happen in that community and be, like, one of those good, like, activist gays, too. And, you know, kind of like be the happy, helpful one and like be on that code. And then while simultaneously also letting people know that discussing the very private ways that I engage in intimacy with my partners is not like a public discussion. And like engaging in conversations like that does not represent like you trying to be helpful or trying to be an ally or trying to reach out to me. It's actually quite perverse. And that's like, those are the two like places that I find myself like walking in between.
I'm so glad Phoenix brought that up. I'm coming to realize that there's a bit of a generational divide here, a little bit wider than I thought there was originally. But some of us on this chat come from a time when being any kind of queer identity came with, and not to say that there aren't still these questions out there, but they are not seen as quite as acceptable to ask, maybe, or if they're asked, they'll be quieted down by maybe other people sometimes before you are tasked with responding. But really, really personal questions asked by strangers, coworkers, bosses of mine in my mundane job about what goes on in my bedroom, that for some reason I have to now have a discussion about, or you think that that's an acceptable thing to ask. These kinds of questions, are they still happening to you? How do you deal with them when they come up?
So when that does happen to me, I like very specifically reflect it back. So are you asking me how I have sex? Is that the question? Are you asking about my gag reflex because you're referencing oral sex? Like, is that what's happening here? And like, of course I can do the tone of like keep making my voice get higher and higher and higher and like add on the intensity and the sarcasm. And like just at the trope where like someone thinks that I'm joking, I'll say, I wonder if this is a conversation that should happen with our supervisor too. Or is this something that has to like be addressed with pastor or with auntie or with whoever, right? Are you asking about my genitals?
I've been in positions where I was actually reprimanded for not being gay enough in certain scenarios. where, you know, I was in like a sales job and the client wanted the gay experience of like getting sold to by like the gay guy in the fashion boutique. And they wanted me to like do that. I mean, we can all put it on. And like, I don't know if I'm like with dear friends and feeling very comfortable and in a certain kind of mood, I might behave in a certain kind of way, but like turning that on to play a role for you in this public professional setting is not something I plan on doing. Anybody relate to that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I relate to it, especially from a sales point of view. When I used to work in a department store, there were literally, because I'm quite introverted naturally, even though I jump around online and shout and scream in my videos and such, I'm quite quiet and not as sociable in person. And also, I've spoken to you before, Philos, about this. I'm not very good with the pop culture. I don't know celebrities. I don't know anything like that. And on one side, there was the co-workers who were very kind of, they found that very jarring that I didn't know anything about like the current reality TV show that was popular or the latest season of RuPaul's Drag Race. I'd be there like, I don't really know what's going on there. And they'd be like, wow. And I remember this one woman saying to me once, one of my coworkers, she turned to me and she said, it's weird to think that I'm queerer than you are because I didn't know what was going on in RuPaul's Drag Race. And I was like, okay, cool. And then on the other side, it was because customers would come in and they expected you to have a like back and forth conversation with them. And I wasn't very good at that. And I remember one of my supervisors once coming to me and being like, maybe you should be a bit more chatty, you know? And she turned to me and she went, just pretend you're, and this is a very kind of UK thing to say, so I'll give a translation at the end. But she said, just pretend you're out on Canal Street and you're with your friends at the bars. And Canal Street is the main kind of gay area of Manchester in the UK. And I was just like, I've never even been to Canal. Well, I have, but I've never really gone for a night out on Canal Street. I don't know what you mean. And it was just the implication behind what she said. It was like, wow, why?
I haven't. So because I am part of the younger generation, that experience of being like not gay enough or too queer, that doesn't happen. But what Phoenix had said about like the inappropriate questions, I did experience because I used to work at a supermarket and my bosses would just ask me about my girlfriends and my boyfriends and everything like that. And especially when I told them that I was polyamorous, they were like, how does that work? And I'm like, yeah. They're like, did they know? I'm like, yes, they know.
There's an app. So I want to ask, what were each of your introductions to witchcraft? Pagan spirituality, occultism, witchcraft, magical community, whichever term that you personally apply, what was your introduction to it? And a couple of parts to this question. When you were first introduced to it, did you immediately feel welcomed by it? And did you feel included in it? And I think we all know that those are two kind of different things sometimes.
Yeah, so my initial step into the witchy world was a solitary one. However, when I did find like another human being who was like practicing and also studying and willing to like talk about it like out loud, I did feel welcomed. And the resources that we shared were also like pretty welcoming resources. Christopher Penzeck, Silver Ravenwolf, Raymond Buckland, Scott Cunningham, like the OG, well, from where I sit, like OGs. Gerald Garner, Doreen Valente, like, you know, Patricia Crowther also, like these people. And so the perspectives were like, they were pretty, you know, along both the sexual orientation and like, quote unquote, like, gender, like still binary, but like there was a big representation that made like witchcraft seem far more appropriate for me as a little gay boy who was also studying witchcraft. Like, how do you just wake up and become that person? Like, what's that? And so I actually attribute those two moments together as like me recognizing that I could speak very seriously with higher power, because they could communicate both the difference in my sexual orientation and my ability to connect at like the same time through like the same mediums.
Well, I was introduced to witchcraft from quite a young age. I think I had a very strange kind of relationship with entering the community, so to speak, because it started in my preteens, and most people are a bit older when they get into this stuff. But my first, I always kind of split my introduction to witchcraft into two categories. There was the first side where I was much more solitary and I didn't really talk to many people apart from one person who I class as my earliest mentor. But then later on in my life, because originally I was very drawn to the Wicca side of it all and the generic kind of eclectic witchcraft of it all. And those are the kind of books I read. I read a lot of Scott Cunningham, Doreen Valiente, and then also just whatever book I could find in the charity shop, because that's all I could afford back then. And then when I was around 16, I was kind of having a bit of a crisis of faith. I knew that I believed in witchcraft, but I didn't feel, I don't know, the eclecticism of it all put me off a little bit, because I felt like I don't really know what I'm doing, and I'm dipping my toes here and there, and this person's talking about chakras while this person's talking about the Greek gods, and it was really kind of confusing for me. And so I kind of went searching to see, like, well, what culturally is significant for my area? Like, what would we have here in Wales that was associated and attached to the culture that I grew up in? And that led me to the lovely Christopher Hughes, who was the chief of the Anglesey Druid Order. And Christopher Hughes was a larger than life, very gay man who was also his personality. I mean, he's, to me, he's this like really multifaceted person. He's like the embodiment of a triple deity. He's got his mortician side, which is very serious. He works with the dead, literally. And then he's also a druid, which is very fantastical and mystical. And then he's also a very highly respected and well-known drag queen in Wales as well. So he kind of like drew me into this Welsh side of it all through his druidry. But then the fact that he was also this almost like a queer mentor for me growing up. He was the first gay man that I really met that wasn't of my own age range. He was much older than me. And so he introduced me to this idea that, you know, like paganism is inclusive to all. And I'd always had that idea, this idea that compared to the more traditional religions that people turned to over in my area, that paganism was much more accepting to gay people and trans people and queer people in general. And I don't know, he embodied that for me. And so he was quite empowering. But then my first kind of, I don't think that my queer identity really played a role in my craft until I came out as trans. And that's when I met a few covens who were not as accepting as I was led to believe that witches were. And yeah, it's kind of, it woke me up to this idea that even the pagan and witchy communities have troubles.
So my first introduction to practicing is kind of lame. I had a boyfriend at the time, and he kind of dabbled in magic, and I had recently bought a tarot deck, and I was like, this could be interesting. And that's the beginning of it. And I'm like, that's such a human thing. Like, it's the silliest thing, but it's how it started. But how I actually started to practice hoodoo was I started getting these dreams and these visions that I would just wake up from, and I just had to do so much research, and I was like, this feels like my ancestors. This feels like something I'm meant to be doing. And I got a reading from a good friend of mine, Afro-spiritual, and he said, start practicing hoodoo. And I was like, okay, let's throw myself into it, which is really hard to do when you're also going to grad school, because it's like research and other research. And I just felt like the hoodoo community, it's both like we want to be one because we are, but at the same time, it's so so closed off because you don't know who knows what and who's trying to misinform you, who's fake, who's what. So you can really only trust a few people. And I kind of cling to Afro-spiritual as a very close friend of mine who's in hoodoo. But besides from that, there's always the internet, and the internet is not very reliable, and I hate that. So inclusivity wise, I'd have to say that it's not always been so good, because for hoodoo, you just got to put your foot down sometimes and say, this isn't right. And the books that are out there are like, a lot of the time it's good information, but then there's always marketeer hoodoo. And I'm just like, I don't know who to trust all the time. So it's definitely hard.
Can you define for folks that don't know what marketeer hoodoo is?
Yes. Marketeer hoodoo. So basically there's hoodoo that was done by Black people and people that were enslaved. And then we would give our products to the community to help the community. But white people would come in and take those products for themselves and resell them. And it's called marketeer hoodoo because it's like the snake oil type situation. They would sell it for a profit, and it would just do more harm than good to the community. So we as Black people would have to actually start charging people in the community for the products that we were trying to give them to help them.
I want to ask, because I feel like we're the natural part of the conversation, where I want to ask about the idea that so much of pagan, witchy, magical, spiritual discourse is wrapped up in fertility. Paganism, the pagan umbrella, is often called a fertility religion or a fertility community, fertility religious community. And I know that, I mean, since the day I started my podcast way back in 2009, one of the earliest and most consistent questions that I've ever got, in fact, I got this question again just like 3 or 4 days ago on social media, was, as a gay man, how do you interact with this fertility religion when it is so focused on divine penis, divine vagina?
Okay. So I've heard this before. I have, even in hoodoo, I've heard this before. And at first I was like, how do I deal with this? Because I was told that I needed more masculine energy in my life. And I'm like, okay. I've kind of turned it around as a non-binary person just to say it's divine energy. It's because why does energy have to have a gender or genitals? Like, it doesn't have to. And we are all matter. We all have energy, and our energy is our own. So and I'm a very femme presenting person. So it's like, maybe this is my divine feminine energy, but that doesn't mean that I lack the masculine energy. So it's what you want to encompass. And just because you encompass more of one rather than the other, doesn't mean that you are lacking.
Phoenix, you actually still, I mean, you are a practicing Wiccan. You're a Wiccan high priest, right? So this is a big concept inside of Wicca. How do you interact with that?
Yeah. So when folks have a discrepancy about this, usually what I do is I take a deep breath and I try really, really hard to put myself in check as I proceed to remind folks about the complexity that is tied up in theological concepts, specifically magical theological concepts. And I remind folks that we have to understand these things from multiple levels. So we have to understand genitalia, we have to understand tools, we have to understand interaction, and we have to understand humanity, and we have to understand divinity through various levels, and it's exemplified by the as above, so below. And the cultural development of like Wicca being like the indigenous kind of like tribal or one of like the tribal remaining religions from Europe, right? So when it comes to fertility, maybe we want to think about tribes really wanting to celebrate new birth coming into the community. And so that fertility was very much celebrated. However, that's not where the story stops, right? Divinity reflects all types of patterns of creation. So humanity follows that exact same pattern. So just because you don't remember in a reconstructionist faith, if that's what you want to call Wicca, or just because you don't remember in an eclectic faith, or just because you don't remember because you piecemealed very different parts of your faith together, what other people's tools were used to do to create and instill and secure community doesn't mean that it didn't have a very real, very spiritual, very powerful application in our world. Doing more research into the particular theology that like does support Wicca, a lot of times we will recognize that it's the queer people exclusively who made up the priesthood that was the craft of the wise. So when folks like visualize themselves talking to kings and emperors and reading charts and so on, back in the day, it was the queer folks. And like, maybe they weren't so apt to like tell you what their genitals looked like because maybe that wasn't important to them like it was now. Because at some point, puritanical values got wrapped up into how we've come to understand this faith. And that's some shadow work that has not been done by everyone. And you can tell when someone's puritanical shadow work has not been done because they get wrapped up in your sex and not theirs.
Well, I want to first start off by saying, you know, if we're going to talk about the current recent conversations going on, I've seen it a lot on my feed lately, and I've not touched upon it yet myself because I've not really formulated what I want to say about it. But I've seen a lot of my mutuals, a lot of people that I follow, a lot of people that I admire, putting out posts and such on social media that say things like, oh, we need to get over this idea that the divine feminine and divine masculine is offensive to trans people and actually focus on real issues like actual transphobia in the community. Stop talking about these metaphors. But I have a struggle with that discourse because I am an actual trans person and most of these people that I've seen writing about this stuff aren't. And I do have an issue with the divine feminine, divine masculine thing, not as a concept, because I think as a concept, we can definitely look, like you said, the passive and whatever forces, we can definitely look at them in those regards and see them as useful and beneficial to our spirituality and religious practices. But the issue I have with this idea of stop talking about it, it's just concepts, they're not actual things that we believe, is you can say that all you want, but at the end of the day, people are taking them as literal and using it against people who are trans and who do not identify within the binary modes of thinking. I mean, my first interaction with someone who genuinely believed in this hyped up idea of duality was when I was around 15, 16, and I went to my first ever witch fest, and I was still presenting as male at this point. And I met a coven who specifically told me very bluntly that gay men, trans women, and lesbians cannot be fully powerful witches because they lack the duality in their being. And that was, as a young teenager at that point, that was very jarring to me because that was my first example of somebody who was not as accepting in the community. And I mean, like I said, when I first came into this, there was this hoo-ha of paganism and witchcraft is so much more accepting than the other religions. And then for the first time I ever go to a broader community event, for someone to say that to me, it was like, oh, are we as accepting as we make it out to be? So I think that's something that a lot of people, especially cis and het people who do not interact with transphobia on the daily basis, really need to consider, is when they're saying things like, we need to focus on real issues like transphobia, not divine masculinity and divine femininity, is they need to realize that sometimes that concept feeds into the transphobia in the community and the homophobia that happens in the community as well. So yeah, it's a struggle because I've kind of just erased it from my personal spiritual practice. But
so I did want to say, Mara, that you've perfectly highlighted like the evidence of heteronormativity in like the pagan theological system. by like not readily acknowledging or showcasing deities who do represent like more of a transitional or more of a spectrum kind of like way of being. And like you've also highlighted collectively how we seem to miss the lesson about binary, even in like magical theology, being a very limiting, not powerful kind of thing, right? Like it's the duality that led to the break and like, you know, the mess. So I thank you for saying that like very nicely and like very, very explicitly, because it is evident and like it's not something that people do want to talk about like explicitly.
Yeah. I mean, I think I have a very strange relationship with it because my culture is Celtic. So Wales is a Celtic nation and the mythology that we have is Celtic. And I've been in so many various groups and gatherings where there's people from all over the world that come, and almost everyone attributes this duality thing and the idea of, you know, especially with the triple goddess, the whole mother, maiden, crone, a lot of people attribute that to the Celtic pantheons. And in a lot of ways it doesn't really work, because that's not the way, if you look at the original mythos, that these goddesses and such were presented. And then I always question, like, okay, if you're going to focus on this goddess who apparently exemplifies the maiden, mother, crone, why are we ignoring also these two deities? So for example, if I were to use my religious practice as an example, we've got two deities called Gwydion and Aranrhod. And both of these deities exemplify breaking away from gender norms and not doing what was considered appropriate for their gender at the time. And they're very potent, powerful deities within our pantheons. So it's almost like, why are we exemplifying one aspect and saying that that's the be all and end all when we also have these within? And I mean, that's just looking at it from a Welsh Celtic perspective. We've got so many others from various other cultures, ancient cultures in the world, that exemplify more than just duality and the idea of divinity existing within masculine and feminine.
How has your magical identity evolved with your personal identity? Has it evolved parallel? You know, as you've grown spiritually, so too has your journey to, you know, your own understanding of yourself, or has it been perpendicular? You know, as you've grown one way, maybe you've grown in a completely different way personally.
I would say that they're diverging in a odd way, because my practice is becoming more strict in the fact that I have rituals and I have to venerate my ancestors and deities I have responsibilities to that. But my identity with myself has become more lenient, and I've kind of grown away from labeling myself as like these like strict labels, and kind of just gone with umbrella terms that are just like, I'm queer, I'm non-binary, I'm on a spectrum here, and I can be whatever I want to be. But in my practice, it's kind of just like, you need to do all of this research and stick to schedules, and I enjoy that though. I really enjoy what I'm doing with my practice and with myself, even though they don't seem to align together.
Can I ask you, honey, because I know that in our conversations leading up to this show, you told me that you don't identify as pagan.
I don't.
That's not a term that you apply to yourself. Can I ask a little bit about, you know, was it ever a term that you tried on and then you cast away, or has it just, and why?
So I haven't. I have never identified as pagan, and I might upset some people with saying this. So I have heard, I think the correct word to use here would be discourse, but
I can see the sparkle emojis next to the word discourse.
But I have heard that a couple of Black pagans that don't feel included being Black and pagan in the community. And I never really wanted to feel that way, one. And I never really identified with the word pagan. So I just never gave it much more thought than that.
I know, Mara, you've done a lot of talking about like the word witch, but also some used terms from the Welsh as well, that some people use and try on and are misappropriated.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's more from my Welsh side of things, because there's a lot of the discussion surrounding witchcraft and magic in Wales is muddied up by the discussions of witchcraft and magic in England, because we're often seen and conflated as being, we're just part of England. And even though we're our own country, we're not seen as our own identity. But the kind of culturally specific way of looking at what a witch is was very different between England and Wales. And the biggest example of that was the fact that compared to England, we had virtually no witch trials. And where witch trials did happen in Wales, it was in areas where there was a high concentration of English living there, of people who had moved to Wales. And I mean, I think people forget a lot that Wales has been under the rule of England for so long that, of course, we're going to muddy up the kind of culturally specific terminology to do with things like that. So in Wales, we have this term called gwrach. And I've seen it so much, especially in the pagan spheres, where people will call themselves a Welsh gwrach. And the word gwrach is used in fantasy to denote a witch nowadays, within like if you're doing a TV show or a book about witches, and we're talking about like, you know, the pointy hat witches riding on broomsticks, then you'd say gwrach. But the etymology of the word gwrach stems in very kind of horrendous terms associated with older women. It's a slur towards older women. That's how it started. It was a slur targeted towards the older generations, and specifically older generations who might have been disabled, disfigured in any kind of capacity. It was a term that was used like towards people who were blind or who had some form of disability that wasn't fully accepted in that era. And so then eventually over time it's evolved so that gwrach became the Welsh equivalent of hag. And then of course, after that became the Welsh equivalent of witch, because hag and witch are terms that are often conflated as being associated with one another. But throughout the history of Wales, we have all these different terminologies, because magical practitioners within our country were separated, and there wasn't just one. It wasn't just a witch. You had the Suin Gavadeth, people who practice Suin Gavadeth were referred to as the Suin, and we actually have three terms, which is a male, female, and a gender neutral terminology for the Suin. So you've got the Suin Wraig, which refers to a female who practices magic, a Suin Ur would be a man who practices magic, and then a Suinir would, or a Suinith, would be someone who is just someone who practices magic and isn't associated with any gender at all. And so I'm one of my biggest kind of agendas going on the internet is to try and teach people that gwrach is not the most appropriate term when you're talking about it in Welsh. But yeah, I think I struggled like to jump on what Honey said. Sorry, that was a bit of a tangent on the Welsh side. But to jump on what Honey said, I struggled with the terminology of pagan for years and years and years because of being trans, because I thought that the term pagan conflated that you were part of these fertility kind of traditions, and being a trans woman, I didn't identify with that, you know, with the idea of duality and the way that the gender binary were almost seen as held in high regard within pagan communities. And so I stripped away from paganism as well. And of course, once I was kind of becoming more globally aware of issues going on as well, there was also the talk of, especially here in the UK, when someone says pagan, they mean white people, like specifically when they say it here. They literally, like, if you ask someone what is a pagan woman, they will point you towards like these Celtic looking kind of long red-haired maidens running in the wind on their horses,
holding their bread.
Yeah, holding their bread. Or they'll point you towards the Norse, the Vikings. And, you know, it's almost as if in Britain and most of Europe, the idea is that pagan is a term that is specifically associated with white people only. And I think I can relate from the trans side of it, like understanding that I wouldn't want to relate myself to pagan at one point because I didn't want to conflate myself with this gender duality and binary. But then it wasn't until I spoke to a friend who said that she didn't feel comfortable referring to herself as pagan because she's not white, that I kind of went, oh my God, there's so much more to that than I thought. And that was my privilege showing that I didn't realize there was more to it than just this gender thing. It was also like how muddied up into this idea of like white culture has paganism become almost.
Yeah, pagan does imply pretty white, doesn't it? But all that being the case for me, there wasn't like much of a struggle kind of trying it on, looking at like what it meant for me, how I like applied it to myself as like a spiritual and cultural thing and not necessarily like with an ethnic component. However, more education and more personal education about like the definitions of pagan and like where certain authors like kind of truncated the definition and didn't finish it out, like led to like a deeper understanding of what that term meant, as well as like a galloping rampage for like other terms and how like the fact that there was a term for this type of person in every culture became more important to me. And so like that's kind of where I am now, just being like, actually no, we all come from a place that has a name for the type of person who lives and practices like this, and if like they were like anywhere near a colonial power, they probably got demolished. If they were touched by any place that had like, you know, a Christian like uprising, like they probably got demolished. Like it's and if they weren't touched by that, then like they're a living tradition, and like that's kind of where you have to recognize where the boundary is.
So you would say that for you, you find power, you find strength in reclaimed terms, in whatever it meant is whatever it meant. Here's what it's going to mean for me now. I am going to decide what this means for me.
Not necessarily me deciding what the term is, but me finding out that there is a term for this in various places. So I'm not necessarily going to say that this is what I am, right? Like I am not a this from this place, but I'm like, hey, it's like the thing from here. So like a sandwich is like something different someplace else, but like, here's the concept.
I'm going to be real honest and a little vulnerable. I had to have a very similar journey with the word queer. And this is probably a big generational thing. I don't know if you all get this or not, but it was 100% all the way a slur up there with the F word. It was up there. It was the same. I remember distinctly getting it screamed at me as people spat on me and kicked me and beat the living shit out of me. I remember it was one of the things that when I was gay bashed outside of that club in East Texas and, you know, sent to the hospital and all of that, it was one of those terms. And I was like, there is no power in this for me. There is no strength in this for me. I hate this term, and anybody that uses it is blind to that. It has taken me a very long time just to be able to say the word. I mean, just to say it and then to say it without the sting and then to say it and not hate it and to say it and be okay with it and then like it. And then be okay with being in it and having it mean me too. There is I'm gonna really admit I'm still a little. Sometimes when I say it, I have to remind myself that I mean me too. Like I have to like take a second and like get okay with it again. But. Does anybody else have anything like that, you know, in or outside? I mean, we don't have to be witchy for a second. Go ahead, Mara.
I mean, I can definitely relate to the queer thing because same. I struggle with looking at myself as queer. When I say queer, I almost feel like a fraud for saying it as if it's a positive term. And I almost feel like I'm going to get reprimanded and told off for saying a horrid word. And I think that comes from being British as well, because we don't have the F word, as you said here, for gay men specifically. We don't have that term. We don't use that. Nobody does, not a single person. It's starting to become a thing now, unfortunately, among the not so small homophobic population, but it's only just starting to take a grip over here. And I think it's based on the fact that people are starting to pick it up from American kind of media and such. But for me, when I was growing up, it was queer. Queer was the term that people used against me. And I remember distinctly when I was about 20, 21, I said to my mother, I think, something like, oh yeah, I'm going on like this queer pagan gathering thing that's online. And she looked at me and she went, you can't say that. You can't say that term. How dare you? And I was like, mother, you are a straight woman. Why do you care what I'm saying? But she was so like flabbergasted by the idea that I said queer. And so, yeah, I still struggle with that one specifically. And also there's a culture, I don't know if it's the same over there in America, but there's a culture as well at the minute of reclaiming slurs. Such as the I don't want to say it, but the trans slur, you know, the one that ends with E. And then, there's
are people trying to reclaim that?
Yeah, people are like, I have friends. Heard that. And it's not even like, most of the time, it's not even trans women who are reclaiming it. It's usually drag queens over here. And I struggle with it so much because I'm just like, no, that's not your word. You shouldn't be using that. But it's, yeah, I struggle with the queer as well.
I know RuPaul got into some pretty, pretty hot water because, and I understand why folks like RuPaul thought that they had a claim to use the term, because they did use it to do good in a period of time when what they were doing was breaking boundaries and moving forward social discourse and doing the whole gender fuck thing. And I understand that it used to be a sort of a package of ideas and identities and ballroom and a way of being in that world in the 80s. But it is 2021 and we have come a very long way. And it is, I think that sometimes we need to remember that it is great that you broke down that door, but you broke that down that door so that we could step through it and go somewhere else. Honey is very enthusiastic. I don't know if this is active listening or if this is like, yes.
It's both. Okay. It's both. Because I like drag. I thoroughly enjoy drag. I'm not talented enough to do drag. But I've watched RuPaul's Drag Race for most
sure.
of my mom.
I'm sorry, did you just say for most of your life?
Yes.
Oh God, I'm sorry. I just need to fall in a hole and die. Yes, continue, please.
but watching RuPaul like say all these words, and I'm like, at the time, like there wasn't a lot of pushback, but then, or maybe there was and I just didn't know, but now going back and rewatching, or even just other shows, hearing slurs that were acceptable back then, and I'm like, we have moved past it and we need to keep moving past it. And that doesn't mean that you can't reclaim things. I think reclaiming things for yourself is okay, but pushing them onto other people is not okay. Like I use queer for myself because it makes me feel comfortable. I would never ask anyone else to call me queer just because I use it for myself. I actually, my name on TikTok used to be Queer Babe, and I actually changed it because a friend of mine would not say it out loud. And I was like, I'll change it because I don't want to make anyone else uncomfortable having to say it if they don't want to.
There's power in recognizing that I am okay with doing something, and you know, maybe I have a friend who is okay, and this is our relationship, and there's a way that we can talk to each other, and there's a way that we can interact with each other. But when I go outside of that little interaction or that small circle of friends or something, and I say something, sure, there's a real chance it could cause harm. Mm-hmm. And just because it was acceptable over here to do doesn't mean it's always acceptable for everyone everywhere. And I think that we forget that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a lot that we forget. So the difference between an open group conversation and a closed group conversation, first certain, also remembering that not everybody knows the context for what your statement is coming from, like, or where that originated, or the history that you have with that statement. And like, also a lot of times, I don't know why or how, but like sometimes people forget that they are wandering into a very charged moment and forget that like this very likely will come back, especially if it's being recorded.
Absolutely.
You gotta think when you say stuff like that. You gotta make sure that your perspective is clarified appropriately if you're just gonna like make a statement that can just be taken by anyone hearing it. And like that is a responsibility that you get when you get a platform.
And some of us here have very large platforms. Have you, Mara, Honey, have either of you sort of run into that where you were taking something that meant something to you? I mean, have you ever found yourself on the other side of it and accidentally been the oppressor just by dint of the fact that you were bringing something that you thought was acute, that was okay for you personally in one of your in-groups? And then you brought it to the out-group of TikTok or the out-group of social media, and suddenly somebody was like, the hell?
I don't think I have, because I try to be very careful with my words, because I present myself as like bubbly and friendly, and I don't want to make anyone mad, because there's the rhetoric of the angry Black person, and I don't want to be that. So I always try to keep the smile on, and I try to choose my words very carefully, and I get very anxious about doing the wrong thing.
I agree with that. I definitely agree with that. I mean, I think it's a little easier for me because I almost have an entirely different persona on my TikTok. It's like I'm not 100% myself. And a lot of people get annoyed at that because I don't put regular content out, because I'm not the type who will make a video sitting in my living room. I have to always be kind of performing. But because of that fact that I do perform, it means that I'm really careful, not just because I'm worried about offending people, but because I almost don't want to slip the fantasy in some ways. And that's been helpful for me, because it means that I take a lot of time and a lot of patience goes into making something that I put out there. But I mean, I've got, I think, about 74 videos in my drafts that I just make randomly, and I leave them in that drafts for like weeks, months. I think I've got some in there from January still at the minute, because I like to watch them over and over again to ensure that what I'm putting out there is correct information, that the things I say are okay and decent. And also because I don't know, I think I have often seen people be torn apart for making like one mistake, like one quick mistake. So I'm like, I'm not going to be that person, but maybe I should knock on wood. But yeah, it's, I don't think I've personally dealt with it yet.
But it definitely sounds like both of you are aware of the pressure and the responsibility to like keep it like legit.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, I do have a follow-up question for the two of you is, actually, so first of all, thank you both for like low-key telling people how to keep it legit by explaining your processes like just now. Like, that was genius. Like, the follow-up question is like, what's the mediation between keeping it authentic to yourself and putting out like that content that does vibe with your soul, while also making sure that like you dance on the eggshells of like the people who are like trying to eat you?
I don't know if Honey can agree with this, but I struggle a little bit, especially with TikTok, with like having a platform. I sometimes feel like I should be talking about some things. I should be talking about certain issues going on in the world and such. But then I worry, I've got two things going on in my head all the time. I'm like, do I know enough? And will I put my foot in it if I do try talking about it and say something that isn't quite right? And I don't know, I struggle with that, especially like not only being someone with a platform, but being a white woman with a platform. I'm like, you know, people are going to listen to me, unfortunately, because that's the society we live in. And I don't know, I struggle with that a lot. Like you said, walking on eggshells almost, like on one hand, I've got the side of me that's saying, well, no, because your niche is Welsh witchcraft, so nobody expects you to talk about those things. But then I want to, because they're things I'm passionate about as well. But then also, how do I go about it in a way that fits my brand and is done in a way that's correct? So I don't know. It's a hard one. And it is a question of authenticity as well. Like, how do you stay authentic to you while also sticking within your thing?
That's such a mood. Like, it really is. It's such a mood, because I do think that I'm still authentically myself, even if I am being careful, because that's kind of me. I'm kind of careful. I'm not really the daredevil. But I also understand, like, sometimes you're like, should I talk about this, even if I have the place to talk about this? Or would it mess up, like, people's view of me? And usually I end up saying, I'm going to talk about it because I want to talk about it and I think it deserves to be talked about. I do have, like, a couple of friends that I'll just, like, if I have a video that's, I'm like, is this going too far? I'll send it to them. And usually they're like, you're fine. So I remember an example of that was a video I made a couple of months ago. And I don't know if you know the TikTok trend where it was like, oh, this one person, hello. Oh, this other person, hello. And it's like gunshots. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Actually, you don't know what I'm talking about. So I'll send it to you later.
I thought it was the dancey thing, but that's not the thing.
But I had done a video where it's like, oh, we're the witches that you couldn't burn. Oh, we're the people that you actually did. And it's like trendy people that just get into witchcraft for fun. And then it's like, for the aesthetic. And then it's like, people of color. And so many people were like, either saying like, they didn't actually burn people, or like, this completely disregards other practices. And I'm like, you didn't get the point. The point was that people of color were actually like hurt because they practiced their practices, and you're out here saying this. So like, I understand like taking a risk sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. My formula for addressing people is usually like, I won't speak publicly on any topic or issue unless I'm invited to that conversation. That way, when I do inevitably say something that pisses someone off, my immediate response is, you called me, remember? I never want to project my perspective or the way that I apply my theology or the way that I build knowledge onto the worldview of other people, right? All this is like my worldview, and like, I have to be very careful about that and how I present that. And so like, my goal in my position, in my platform, is not to teach people how to live and apply as I have lived and applied, but rather that there is a process for living and applying these things that are important to you. And engaging in that is like what we want to be doing. Engaging in that is how we help each other. Engaging in helping people understand their own process is like the great work of like the magical people, and not necessarily dictating what that process is for others.
So none of us were born into our current spiritual traditions. These are things that we found and that we have chosen and that we have embraced. Whereas each of our identities, non-binary, trans, gay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, these are part of who we are. These are our intrinsic identities. These are things that we were born as. We might continue to discover them throughout our lives, but these are the people that we were born to be. So I want to talk about that intersection of intrinsic identity with chosen identity. And does your chosen identity feel as much a part of you as your intrinsic identity? Do you ever find, controversial, do you ever find that you choose one over the other, that you will choose your intrinsic comfort level over, say, your spiritual comfort level? Or do you push, you know, do you push the boundaries of your personal comfort level because of what you want to do spiritually, or vice versa?
So for me, like, they developed simultaneously, like they developed at the same time. But I will find that when it comes to talking about my identity, I will lead with the one that's most relevant. And I do often find that my chosen identity and my intrinsic identity support each other, whereas there are some post-traumatic growth elements that my intrinsic identity has given me that helps me be strong when parts of my chosen identity are, you know, being derided against or where I have to defend in that way. So I find that, you know, the parts of my identity that are intrinsic versus the chosen do function as a puzzle piece to support like the overall kind of image of me moving about in the world.
I think my chosen identity definitely helped me to come to terms with my intrinsic identity over time, because I grew up kind of knowing that I wasn't fully comfortable in the way I was presenting myself, but I didn't have the terminology to say like, oh, I'm trans or anything like that. But when I look back at, I mean, like I said, I've been practicing since I was a preteen. So I've been going to moots and things and meditation classes since I was a very young teenager, from like 13, 14. And at those periods in time, I used to joke with my friends like, oh, I'm going to be, at that point, I was like, I'm going to be the old man who's like really like strange and quirky. And I'm basically going to grow my beard out long like Dumbledore. And I'm going to be that weird wizard person that you see at the supermarket and think like that person's not real. But when I said that to my friends, it was always kind of in a jokey way. And there was something always like wrong. And then I always look back and think like when I used to do any kind of meditations or visualization exercises, I always viewed myself as a woman in those. And when I imagined myself when I was older, like when someone would say, oh, how are you going to be when you're older? When I really did imagine it, I always imagined myself as a woman. And I remember looking through my books at 13 years old, by the way, just before anyone starts judging me, at 13 years old, flicking through my spell books that I had at the time, looking for like a gender change spell or something to see if it was possible. So I do think that like my chosen identity did help me. But I will admit as well that I think I hide in my chosen identity a lot, I think. And that's something that I've started admitting to myself a lot. I was talking to my partner the other day and I said to him, you know, like I've hidden for so long in my life, like not just being trans, being queer in like a rural area, growing up in a rural farm area and being queer, being trans. Not only that, but also being autistic and not really understanding social cues and things like that, not having any friends. I've hidden for so long that it's almost as though magic became another aspect of life that I hid within. And I think I still do it to this day, where I sometimes look at, I have this one friend from university who is this queer activist who always posts about anything to do with kind of queer activism that's going on right now, especially in the UK, anything that's going on like petitions wise and things like that. And I look at his profile and sometimes I feel guilty because he's out there putting all of this information out there and being at the forefront of activism within the UK queer community, whereas I'm here talking about spell bottles. And there's a part of me that feels guilty for that. Like, should I be talking more about the trans experience in the UK, especially with things that are going on right now with the dreaded Harry Potter author and such, and the issues that have stemmed from her that a lot of people probably don't realize have stemmed from her now as well within UK politics in general and such. And I don't know, I think sometimes I hide within my witchcraft, and there's almost a side of me that sees it as a comfort thing. Like, I find it comfortable to just be a witch, and it's something I'm trying to work on now. Like, maybe it's time to step out and be more than just a witch.
Honey.
I, like I said earlier, my practice and my gender and sexuality kind of diverge. So they don't really help each other. They, if anything, I kind of cling more towards my gender identity and my sexuality more than my chosen practice, because honestly, it's scary because you can fuck up in a lot of ways when you're starting something new and when you're still researching and learning, and that's scary. And with something that I just am, how can I fuck that up? Like, that's just me. And if I can just be me and not have to worry and not have to worry about messing something up or getting backlash or something going wrong, I kind of cling to my my sexuality and my gender more than my my practice. And like Phoenix had said, I when I'm introducing it to other people, I tend to introduce what's the most interesting, like, because it's like, if I'm in a group of queer people, I'm gonna be like, hey, by the way, I practice. And like, or if I'm in a group of witches, I'll be like, hey, I'm queer. Like, it's whatever's not common, because that makes me a little bit more interesting. And maybe you'll want to talk to me about it, you know, maybe you can learn something.
Do you ever find that you embrace one side of yourself because that's the side of yourself in which you have more community? In which you have more camaraderie, friends, acceptance. That's maybe the word easy feels wrong, but it's the only word that's coming to mind right now. But that it's just, it's easier to be gay, it's easier to be trans, it's easier to be queer, it's just easier, which is weird and bonkers to think that it might ever be easy to be one of these things. But I think we all get it, maybe.
Like,
I'm sorry, here, let me, we need to stop and call my therapist real quick. Hi, Sandra. Hi, can we do an emergency meeting? No. But I'm gonna be real honest. I'm in the group with Honey where I'm going to be gay forever. I was gay since the day I was born. I'm going to be gay forever. I came to this path. This community hasn't always been here for me. Oftentimes it feels like they're not here for me on some given day, and I'm going to be gay forever. And that is my default setting. That is my comfort zone at this point. That is where I feel safest. And at times that's the identity I'm going to choose over the other. I do have, even though what's bizarre is that like most of my friends are pagan or witchy people. Like most of my friends are, and I don't know if it's maybe the Honey thing where like, well, then the gay thing is the thing that makes me a little bit different or unique or you know, something like that. Special snowflake in that setting, but it is my more comfortable identity. It is the thing that I feel more confident introducing, and the thing that I feel more confident defending if ever problems arise. Does that resonate with anyone?
No, that resonates 100%.
The Phoenix thing that kind of like resonates with me is with both a queer identity and a witchy identity. Like, they both have a huge history in like oppression and like throughout the ages. So like, of course there's like the history of like the physical violence and oppression, but then there's also like the institutional abuse that comes from like, you know, being a magical person and like potentially being afraid of finding yourself in a hospital for it. And how, you know, types of queerness were absolutely diagnosable as a mental illness. Just up until the third DSM. So like right now we're in the DSM-5, the DSM-3 still had a type of homosexuality that was in there as a diagnosis. So we're only two technical additions out from like these things being stuff that can get you locked away. So when it comes to like which one for me is more comfortable to cling to, I'm just kind of like, oh, one's a cinder block and one is like another cinder block. If I'm having to cling to my identity for like to feel safe or to showcase my value or any kind of motive like that, how can I use these two cinder blocks as tools then? Like, they're very heavy. Like, how can I use them? Because like, there is that history of it being like, you know, harmful to talk about, like, for me as a person. So I don't necessarily cling to either of those when it comes to like how do I introduce myself and like live in my body? Or like, what is the introduction? Like a lot of times I will rely on my intellect, I'll rely on my ability to speak, or I'll rely on my humor. Or like, if I can tell that someone thinks I'm cute when they first see me, like that's where I'll go in order to like build that safety and then start giving other pieces of my identity.
I think you've really given me a bit of an internal crisis when you said, is it to do with the community that we cling to? Because it had me thinking about how I have never really had a queer community surrounding me. So to me, when I was in my formative years, and I was like becoming who I am, it was the witches and the pagans and the druids and the all these people that I turned to, because we didn't have gay clubs. I only knew two other queer people in general, and one of them was a druid. So it's almost like I never had that safe space with my queer identity. I always, and then on top of that, the fact that I don't drink alcohol and stuff, so even when I did become more aware of the queer community, it was so focused surrounding like drinking and going to bars and going to clubs that it just wasn't something that I found was something I could do. So I think you've really given me a bit of a crisis there, where I've gone, oh, maybe that is why I don't connect as much with my queer identity as I do my chosen identity, because I never had that kind of community that I could turn to or lean on. For me, it was always the pagan and witchcraft community here in my area that I clung to. But yeah, a lot to think about.
Yeah, I'm officially changing the name of the podcast to Doing Shadow Work on Maine. So that's just... apparently what we're doing now. I want to talk, because it feels like we're touching on it, on the notion of spiritual bypassing. But I want to approach it from a specific bend. I'd like to know, have you ever had a cishet person of privilege inside the community bypass their bad behavior in regards to homophobia or transphobia or racism by way of claiming that they are also oppressed due to being pagan, and that since they belong to a minority religion, they know what it's like, with winks and nods and elbows?
Yes.
Would you like to elaborate on that, honey?
Yes. I actually read a paper also that was like basically touching on that heavily. And it had said that it was someone's thesis paper for their school and everything, which I found was really interesting that they were speaking on paganism and also Wicca and that for a thesis. But they basically said, why do people come to witchcraft? And one of the reasons that they gave was like, they feel like it makes them seem more oppressed and makes them seem like they can identify as this minority and have a voice in these minority communities. And I was like, oh, we're going there? Oh, okay. And a personal experience that I had was like person would say things like just racist things and expect me as like a token Black friend to just be okay with them. And when I tried to call them out on it, they would blame like either like they would just say like I'm up to date with like the lingo and everything. I know what I'm talking about. I don't think you know what you're talking about. And I'm like, okay. So it's definitely like people want, some people are like, I am a minority because I am spiritual, I am pagan, and I'm like, it's not always the same.
I've definitely like had instances where people have tried to, so this is, I don't know if this is a separate issue, but I've had instances where people have tried to deny my lived experience through spiritual terminology. So for example, there's this one person who's in my life currently, and I'm kind of hoping she'll listen to this, who every time I mention my trauma surrounding transphobia that I've faced, you know, the times where I've been physically or verbally assaulted in the street and such, and that because of that, I don't find it easy to do this or that or this or that. And I've expressed that to this person. They turn to me and they go, as a healer, I think that you are projecting some deeply rooted insecurities now. And I think you'll find that most people aren't transphobic. So you need to get over that. And it'll just be like, I'm internally screaming as she says it, because I'm just like, you've never lived this though. You are a cis woman who has never had to deal with any sort of transphobia in your life. So of course you would think that it's not as big a deal as I do, because you've never had to experience it. But yeah, it's just the fact that she uses that, I'm a healer, so I know. And I've definitely come across a lot of that within the spiritual community around here, especially because I run my own little open spiritual development circle. And yeah, in my like little workplace at the minute, we're having a big discussion on Native American cultural items and whether or not they should be sold in the shop. And we had a woman who said that she was a Native American from the Cherokee tribe in a past life, and she thinks it's okay.
Why is it because always she talked to her ancestors. From the why are they always, always Cherokee, Cherokee? First of all, it's always Cherokee. I don't know why. There's a little myth that most white parents tell their kids in the U.S. and that we're all, oh, your great somebody was a Cherokee princess. Like, I was truly convinced up until a few years ago that I definitely had some Native American lineage somewhere. Like, I went and got a DNA test and I was thoroughly convinced I was going to see Native American and French on both sides of my family, at least in some percentage. And can I tell you just how very not even there, like it's just four kinds of white. It's just four different flavors of mayonnaise made this. And I don't know why anybody would be surprised about that. But can I tell you, like, the cognitive dissonance, the mind fuck that it gave my father to find out that nobody in our family is even remotely a little bit Native American. And that was just all a bunch of hooey. Why? Why is it? Why? Why do we need that?
I mean, congratulations on no one in your family participating in any like observable way in such an atrocity either. Cause like the conditions that make that possible were like awful.
So that's it seems true.
That, like, you know, I'm not having that in there. Some of y'all somewhere.
That's true.
Onto the back to the spiritual bypassing thing. I really do think that that reflects a type of powerlessness that people in general don't know how to cope with.
Hmm.
Can't be with you in your trauma or your pain, so I will do the best that I can to make it seem like it's not there for real. That's the only power I have in this moment, especially as a healer or as a priest or as someone who has donned a mantle that's meant to make me effective in like the projections I make into your life. So if I'm a healer and I can't do anything with the pain that you just shared with me, that's very powerless. And powerlessness will make us all behave very drastically. Now, I do apologize for not telling you beforehand that this is not an excuse for like bad counseling or bad advising, powerlessness. However, I do think that that's at the root. So people who feel powerless and then invalidate other people's trauma, it's easier to just be quiet.
Being quiet's free.
Free.
It's free. What's something that pagan allies do that you wish that they didn't? And what is something that they have done that you wish they would keep doing?
Yes. So I have seen pagan allies in various sized groups around the world, around the country, through visits, through chats, through all of that jazz, mobilize on issues that are very, very important. And I think that mobilizing on issues that are very important and adding like that voice, that common voice and making it louder, is very helpful. And I think that the voice of the pagan, the witch, the magical provider, the magical practitioner, it's not useful if is aimed at another practitioner for any reason, no matter what you believe about their practice, no matter what you believe about your identity, no matter what you believe about your mental. I think that all of us in a magical community, in a witchy community, in a pagan community, could do better by aiming our voice at the thing that keeps us all as a collective human species separate.
I would have to say it both of these have to do with decolonization. I would say pagan allies that do decolonize their practice and are vocal about it and how they do so, awesome. But those that push others to do it and shame others that don't, that's not the way. I think it needs to be that you want to decolonize your practice. Like, once you see other people do it and like how they feel better about doing it, I feel like that's the way to go. You shouldn't shame anyone else for not decolonizing their practice when they aren't necessarily ready.
I think one of my biggest issues with a lot of pagan allies, and just the pagan community as a whole, I'm just going to pick on them all, is the idea that paganism and witchcraft and any kind of spiritual community is better or more devoid of bigotry than the more common world religions such as Christianity and such, implying that we're more accepting because we're witches, we're more accepting, because the truth of it is no, we're not, we're human. There is going to be some biases and prejudices built into us because we're human and we've come from backgrounds where most of us have not been raised in witchcraft. So of course we wouldn't have the same values that are attributed to most of these pagan traditions now ingrained into us from the time we were born. I think if anyone were to just scroll through any Facebook group that is devoted to witchcraft or anything right now and search up terms like trans or black or anything like that, you would find a lot of bigotry and prejudice ingrained into it. Speaking specifically from a trans perspective, what I've seen a lot is people talking over or pushing down the voices of trans people when they say, this is harmful, I don't like this, and then going, well, you're not allowed to decide that. I have my own mind and I can decide this. That's what I see a lot within the communities that I've been part of. For example, when we point out like this book is not very trans friendly and actually it holds some rhetoric that is harmful and possibly violent towards us, please stop recommending it to people. And they go, well, no, because we can still pick and choose what we want out of it and we can decide for ourselves. It's moments like that that I kind of come to the realization that, oh, wow, this whole like, we're just hippies vibing together vibe that people give off isn't quite as accurate as people like to make out. So I think, I guess, stop ignoring the problems that exist within paganism. Just because we are accepting of some things that other religions aren't does not mean we're overall free and devoid of any bigotry and prejudice.
So this episode comes out on June 1st, the beginning of Pride Month. So I think that for my final question for you all, I have to ask a very serious question. Are you ready for like everything to be rainbow? Like just like everything? Like what's the worst rainbow thing you've seen? I'm going to go first. I've had a rainbow grilled cheese. They did somehow get all the colors in there originally, but like by the time it was grilled and you ate it and you pulled it apart, it was like black blue. Like it was, and that I saw it on the menu and I thought rainbow grilled cheese. Well, I'm feeling very gay right now. It's Pride weekend here in Chicago. I'll eat a rainbow grilled cheese.
I don't think I own anything rainbow.
Oh, I would have to say, I have three things that are rainbow. My rainbow Converse, rainbow tube top, and a rainbow like crop top that has like a white trim around the top. Oh my gosh.
The Disney store are doing a mini to go with that Mickey this year as well. Don't know why I know that.
I've got the big gay Mickey stuffy. And I realize that's like the worst thing I could own because of all the capitalism and the bad things.
Yes, like I don't own that many rainbow things. I also don't buy things at Pride. Because like usually what happens is like I'm with a group of people and crash into some folks who are like, here, we're giving out like Pride stuff. So like I live in Buffalo, New York, which means I can go to New York City or I can go to Toronto and like be at a large celebration and just like get stuff handed to me. So like as of right now, the only thing that I own that are rainbow are these like badass pair of suspenders that I wear. Like when I would walk, like work in a mental health clinic, I would wear my suspenders, like my Pride suspenders, you know, a few days during Pride month. And then I have a pair of rainbow socks.
Oh yeah. I've got like three pairs of, yes. Yes. Rainbow socks. Yes.
So that's it. So yeah, like,
Mara, what corporate, trash. please save me here. Do you have corporate trash?
No.
I'm just a bad gay. Okay.
I think I own a Disney backpack, which is rainbow, but it didn't buy it at Pride. It was just like an ombre rainbow backpack. So that's like, but I buy into Disney as well a lot. I can't even think at the minute about anything that comes out at Pride that makes me cringe or anything, but I will mention one thing, and I don't know if anybody from my region will watch that, will listen to this, but if they do, I might get hate crimed. I don't know. But every year, so I don't go to the Pride that happens in my city. I've only been once, but I do walk past where it happens because, oh, being in Britain, it happens at the castle. It's Pride is at the castle every year. And so when I walk past the castle, when I walk past the castle, during Pride, I always die a little inside because the entrance into the Pride area, where they hold all the different Pride events, there's always about two or three huge police cars covered in rainbows and police officers wearing rainbow stood at the entrance. And I always find it really ironic because when I reported the time that I was physically assaulted in this city, they basically gaslighted me and told me that it was my own fault. So I'm always like, oh, wow. So yay, support Pride at Pride, but don't actually help people when they want it to.
Yeah, no police at Pride. This is a no police at Pride show. This is a no police at Pride zone. Phoenix, for folks who want to interact with you online, how can they do that? How can they interact with your services?
Yeah, so Phoenix Coffin Williams on Facebook. You can email me at rev.phoenix1@gmail.com. And then my private mental health practice is called Holistic Wellness and Recovery.
Hi, I am That Honey Witch on TikTok, on Twitter, on Instagram. Best way if you want to have a conversation with me is to tweet at me and we can have a little fun, you know?
You can find me at Mara Starling on TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, everything.
Go to a ring of mushrooms and whisper into the grass and
find a very nice looking puddle, jump in and you'll find me.
I'll try that. Well, thank you all so much for being here. It has been such a pleasure. Thanks for kicking off Pride Month with me. You guys have a good rest of your day.
Thanks, you too.
Well, rioters, that's going to do it here for us today, episode 170, Inciting a Queer Riot. I'd like to once again thank my guests, Mara Starling, That Honey Witch, and Phoenix Coffin Williams. All of their contact information is going to be in the show notes on the blog at incitingariot.com. If you'd like this show and you'd like to support it in some kind of way, there are a number of ways to help. You can consider liking and sharing it on social media. You could also rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your shows and leave a review. Doing so helps boost the show in the algorithm and recommend it to other people like you. Help keep the show free and producing on a regular basis by chipping in whatever you can. You can buy me a coffee, which is a one-time donation of your choosing, or join my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and monthly chats with special guests. As far as extra audio, Patreon supporters got about 25 minutes of additional audio and video, as well as the roundtable this past month featured Cassandra Snow and Meg Ellison. It was a really wonderful time. So if you'd like to become a Patreon supporter, you can do that at patreon.com/incitingprojects. Another way you can support me is to pre-order my book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft. The pre-order link is bit.ly/dabblersguide, capital D, capital G. I have started doing interviews for it, which is a really crazy experience to be on the other side of the microphone. I just did one with the Possibility Department. Please go look for that. And subscribe to her show. It's a really good, awesome pagan podcast. She's done a lot of other really cool interviews. I recommend the one with J. Allen Cross. That was a great interview as well. And also, I just recorded one very late last night with Betwixt and Between. So that's something to look forward to as well. Links to find me on social media if you'd like to connect there. I'm pretty much at Inciting a Riot on anywhere. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and all of that. Please connect with me if you like. Share the show. Thank you guys so much for your support. Happy Pride, everyone. I'm going to leave you, but as always, I will leave you with love and light, firelight.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.